Beginning in October at Unregistered Academy, I will be teaching a 4-part live course on the life and ideas of Michel Foucault, the most influential intellectual of my lifetime. Go to unregisteredacademy.com to learn more and to enroll.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think.
What is this thing called wokeness, and when did it begin? Is it a recent cultural phenomenon that arose spontaneously? Or, as my guest this week argues, was it planned out, deliberate, and put into law more than 50 years ago? This is my interview with Richard Hanania. I am joined from Los Angeles by Richard Hanania. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Good enough, Hanania?
Good enough, close enough. Uh-huh.
And by the way, what is the origin of that name?
I am a my dad's a Palestinian Christian. It's you know, if you go back in history, you find Hananias who are like, you know, Jewish rabbis and stuff, and you know, on Twitter that confuses people a lot. They like to accuse me of hiding my Jewishness, but no, my family is a Christian Arab background.
No kidding. Interesting. Okay. So you have many things about you, but last week you sent me your book, your book that came out, I guess, last fall. The origin.
Oh, no, it's coming. It's coming out
this fall. This fall.
Yeah, a week from tomorrow. So we're recording this on the 11th. So it'll be out there at 9. I don't know when this is getting released, but the 19th it'll be out.
Beautiful. It'll be right around that time. Right. But you've been writing about this topic and speaking about this topic quite a lot for several years. The book. I want to say one thing first of all about it. So the book needs to be read by everybody. It is the best history of the origins of wokeness I've ever seen. Wokeness is kind of a stupid word, and I know you're aware of that, and that's the problem with this whole thing. But, you know, in terms of tracing the development of our current political culture, this is the best I've seen. The second best would be David Bernstein's book on the origins of racial classification, which I know you're very well aware of that book, and you guys are very similar in some ways to me. And I think it's just those two books are absolutely essential to understand anything. I have some disagreements with you about the thesis in your book, although they're minor. And then we have other things to talk about as well. But let's get into this. So the story is, Richard, that liberals lost their minds about 6 or 7 years ago, and they introduced this whole way of thinking that they call wokeness, and that ruined everything. And what we need to do, Richard, is go back to when liberals were not woke and not crazy, and then things will be better. Because back then, before 2015, 16, liberals weren't crazy. They weren't woke. It's new. It's a new thing. So, yeah. I've been annoyed by that for quite a while, although I have a nuanced view of it, but I want to get your history of this first, because you go through the, I guess you could call it the legalization or the institutionalization of wokeness through law since the 1960s. And you go case by case, agency by agency. That's why it's absolutely essential. And I also think your basic thesis is correct. I think that wokeness is at least as old as I am. I was born in 1965. And by the way, you know, you're talking to the right person about this, because I was born in wokeness. I was raised in wokeness. I worked in wokeness. I helped create wokeness in the 1990s. I was one of the whiteness and queer theory scholars of the 1990s who created this fucking thing. So I know this. I know this business. I've been around the left my entire life. You're saying it's not a cultural phenomenon that came upon us recently. You're saying it's as old as I am, at least maybe, and it's rooted in law. So let's start here. Is it the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that's the origin for you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there was a Civil Rights Act in like the words that they put on the paper. And well, first of all, I want to say thank you for the, you know, those kind words. I also, you know, give credit to Dave Bernstein. I mean, I do, you know, cite him a lot for the racial classification stuff. He's also got a great book. But yeah, to the Civil Rights Act, that's, you know, that's Chris Caldwell's thesis. A lot of people, you know, that really put the idea that it all goes back to the Civil Rights Act on the map. But, you know, to answer your question, I'd say yes and no. I mean, there was a Civil Rights Act that was actually written and passed and the one that they debated, and you can go into like the legislative history and what they thought they were doing. And that was one thing. And then there was, you know, the Civil Rights Act as it became interpreted, you know, not in like 2015, but in like in 1966 to like 1971, you know, and that is what basically, you know, started all of this. And so, yeah, the wokeness, you know, you talk about like the last 6-7 years, I sort of see it as like, you know, the mask coming off, like they just sort of, stopped, you know, pretending to be like normie liberals. But the foundations of this stuff was pretty radical. So like people treat, for example, the idea that, you know, if you give a test and blacks don't do as well as whites, the test is racist and it has to be abolished. Or if there's different arrest rates, even if the groups, you know, commit different crimes, that's a problem. You know, that's, you know, people act like that's an idea from, you know, 2014. That's the second Obama administration. No, there's a Supreme Court case called Griggs versus Duke Power Company, 1971, disparate impact. It comes from there. The federal government has been applying the disparate impact standard really since that time. So like in government, in the private sector, wherever you're doing, you basically always have to be, well, first of all, I mean, you have to be looking at your workforce through a gender and through a race lens. You have to see how many women you have, how many men you have, how many people you have of different races. They tell you what the races are. There's 4 American races or 5 American races. And then, you know, they tell you to keep track of what you're doing because it might have a disparate impact in some group, which puts a presumption on you that you're doing something wrong. And a lot of this other stuff like HR, like people, Title IX investigations in universities, they think this stuff just sort of sprouted out of the ground. No, a lot of times it was explicitly created in order to deal with these government regulations or to head off lawsuits or something like that, very intimately connected with the law as it developed. So, yeah, I mean, I think the Civil Rights Act, you know, we can debate whether it was like, you know, I think the Goldwater speech in opposition to the Civil Rights Act actually turned out to be pretty prophetic. He said, you know, it's going to make, you know, he says, I don't like, you know, Jim Crow and I don't like state-sponsored discrimination and, you know, I'm fine with getting rid of that. But he says something like, you know, it's going to require an informer mentality, you know, neighbor spying on neighbor when the government becomes, you know, responsible for ensuring non-discrimination across the entirety of the private sector. And I think he was, you know, and he said it would require something like, you know, a giant police force to enforce all the stuff. He was basically right about everything. The only difference is I think HR, it was sort of outsourced to private industry, in some cases in government, within government itself, but a lot of times just outsourced to these two sort of, you know, these industries and institutions that are sort of parasitic on the civil rights regime. But besides that, he was completely correct. He saw this coming. And yeah, maybe that was just, it was just sort of inevitable when we got government in the business of regulating private relations like that.
So in the 70s, right, the federal government began mandating what we would call DEI, then it was called affirmative action, for any contractor that worked for the federal government. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, it happened. It was the 1972. It was Richard Nixon. First, they started off just by going after, executive order by Lyndon Johnson in 65 called EO11246 and said, you know, if you want to do contract with the government, you have to practice affirmative action to make sure people aren't discriminated against, blah, blah, blah. It really sat dormant. It didn't do anything until the Nixon administration. And at that point, they basically, first of all, Nixon forces it on construction contracts for the government. He says you have to have an affirmative action plan to make sure you white construction industry are not discriminated against blacks, actually to like sort of split the unions from the civil rights establishment. I mean, that's pretty funny. He sold it to there was a rebellion in Congress, like Democrat, like these Dixiecrat Democrats and these Republicans all came together and we're going to like legislate that like Nixon, you can't do this. And Nixon talked the Republicans into not going along with this by telling them, oh, this is good. You know, we're going to, you know, split the labor unions and the you know, the civil rights activists. And then like the Labor Department, just like sort of without, you know, as far as we know, we can tell there's no evidence Nixon actually knew, but extended it to all government contracts. It was just sort of something that was done. It was put in the Code of Federal Regulations through the Labor Department. You know, George Shultz was the Secretary of Labor at the time. He might have been the one responsible for it. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, and you know, there was some limit, like, you know, you have to do, it's today $50,000, but you know, there's some limit above your anyone who's a contractor and their subcontractors too. And this is today a huge portion of the private sector workforce. It's about a quarter of the private sector workforce is either a contractor or a subcontractor of the federal government. And they tell you, these regulations get very detailed. They tell you, here are the races. You divide that. You give us this plan where you have, you know, the number of Asian and Pacific Islander women in management. And then if you don't, you know, if they're somehow unrepresented, and you got to be sort of a social scientist and say like what like the geographic area, the number of qualified people are, and then you have to set goals and timetables to overcome that. So you have sort of like this multi-pronged attack, right? You have this you have this executive order 11246, you have the disparate impact standard, you have private lawsuits, you have Title IX within the university system, you have Title VI, which is government grants. So if the reason government can come after local schools and local, you know, police forces and all these other things for supposed racism is because they all get federal grants, basically.
Right.
And so yeah, it's like this monster with many heads, but it's all sort of doing the same thing.
But did you say roughly a quarter of the American workforce works under this regime?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the ones that are not, and you know, the federal government itself is about 5% of the workforce. So you put that together, you got a third of the workforce.
A third of the workforce.
Kind of affirmative action, executive order regime.
There you go.
And they're often the biggest companies. And so the big, like lower companies will sort of adopt best practices from the bigger companies, or they'll be, you know, they'll want to get contracts in the future. So they have these things just sort of sitting there in abeyance. So it's actually even much bigger than that. But yeah, I mean, it's very direct. Vivek Ramaswamy, I explained this to him and, you know, he's the only one who promised to either repeal or rewrite that executive order. So at least I got one, you know, one presidential candidate listening to me.
Doing well. Of course, he's going to win. So that'll be fun.
well, it's guaranteed now. Yeah. So,
you're going to be the director of HUD, I think. something. Okay. So a third of the workforce, and then also the people that had to be employed to oversee this new racial regime, which is what it is. And to me, it's just a racist regime, but let's call it a racial regime for now. I like that they have to say, here are the races, you know, here are the races. You must know about the races. It's just, It is really, the politics, of course, are fundamentally different, but it's really no different than presentations that were given in 1905 at the Eugenics Society. I mean, it's just like, it's old, good old 19th century racism with a different politics to it. So a third of the workforce, and then all the bureaucrats who have to oversee this regime, all these people are living under or invested in what I've called racial liberalism, wokeness, identity politics. So there is your evidence that law is, what is it? Culture is downstream from law, not the other way around, as Andrew Breitbart said famously, that Breitbart said culture is, or law is downstream from culture. You're flipping that. You're saying that no, it all flows from law in the 1960s and 70s. That's certainly contrary to the way I've always thought about the relationship between culture and law. And you have an entire chapter in your book devoted just to attacking that theoretical question. You want to do that now? I mean, because I think it's bullshit, Richard. I think, come on, obviously Breitbart was correct. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, it's, you know, it's it obviously both influence each other to a certain extent. So it's going to be different depending on what policy issue or what historical process you're talking about. There's some things you can show, like in this context, there's some things you can show very clearly that the law came before the cultural change. So on my chapter on racial classification, I use Google n-grams. The word AAPI, Asian American Pacific Islander, literally did not exist in the English language. There was no book that mentioned it, I think, before 1975.
Totally.
It becomes a government category. Now people get emotional about their AAPI heritage. I mean, you see this, you see like Hulu, you know, I put on Twitter once, I turned on Hulu, it's AAPI Heritage Month. Look at these AAPI stories. Like now people believe that this is a thing. It literally did not exist in the 1970s.
Totally.
Hispanic is pretty much the same thing. You can trace that too. Mm-hmm. You can see Hispanic and Latino goes up. Mexican American, Puerto Rican, people stop thinking about them as individual, you know, ethnic groups mm-hmm. from a certain country or region. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, clear examples of this. And also the civil rights context. I mean, the idea that like, a test is racist, you know, if one group does better than another. I don't think that was part of American culture before Griggs. I don't think that was part of American culture in the 1960s. You could actually go back and look at the debates surrounding the Civil mm-hmm. Rights Act, where mm-hmm. people who are in favor of the Civil Rights Act are saying, mm-hmm. no, you could still set whatever standards you want, even if all the people who meet the standard are white. Like, I mean, they explicitly say this. So the culture of the time that passed the Civil Rights Act believed in colorblind meritocracy. They just thought what the Southerners were doing and the Jim Crow and the explicit discrimination, they just thought that stuff was bad.
Correct.
And so you can just like you, this is why like it requires like, you know, a sort of an in-depth knowledge of the, you know, the history, because you can sort of trace what came before what. The Breitbart thing, there is something to it. You know, I do think that it's not like, I mean, I think, you know, conservatives or libertarians or pro-liberty people, they can use more artists, they can use more cultural influence. I think often it turns into like sort of just like helplessness. Like, it's just like, oh, you know, what are you going to expect from a politician? You know, I was just elected your senator or governor, you know, whatever. It's all downstream of culture. Go make a blockbuster movie. You know, I don't expect anything from me. I think like, you know, I think people on the right are getting a little bit smarter to that. And we are seeing politicians actually do something on this stuff.
I thought that your argument in the book was more that culture and law are indistinguishable, that there's no sort of no point in drawing a line between the two because they sort of constitute each other. They're co-constitutive.
Well, you just blew my mind. I was like,
sorry, man.
That's like a very sort of, you know.
Well, I mean, well, let's just think about the history though. But so the law that you're pointing to is the origin. You point to a 1965 executive order, and then you look at a couple of orders and laws in 1971 and 72. Well, we all know what's been happening just leading up to all that and prior to that, which is the civil rights movement. Which most people say culminated with the 64 civil rights law. Now, also World War II happens, the first war against racism, at least that's how it was billed. And then the entire establishment after 1945 had to say, this is what we stand for as a nation against racism. That's what the Nazis were all about. And we're against that. And so there wasn't there a major cultural change in this country immediately prior to your laws changing?
So the way I put it is they're not like, it's not that they're the same thing. That seems a little bit too, you know, it seems sort of a, you know, hippie-ish. everything is
bad. Just so you know, it's Foucauldian. It's even worse. It's okay. Postmodernist. Sorry. Much worse. You know,
the way I put it was it's a cycle. They're self-reinforcing.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's similar. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, an interesting thing is like people often don't know what the law is. So you pass a law or like there's some regulation. And then you bring on the HR person who sort of, or the lawyer who tells you what the law is.
Totally.
And you just don't know. I mean, you just end up deferring to them. And often they have an interest in telling you, you know, whatever you need to have you need to buy my diversity training or whatever they're trying to sell you. And so, yeah, I mean, I just think that anyone who, you know, just focuses on one of these things now is making a mistake. Now, I think that like, focusing on wokeness, the cultural aspect and these, you know, ideas behind it. I think that market is saturated. I think we have 1,000 books on, you know, this is what, you know, this is what Foucault thought. And this is what, you know, the Frankfurt School, you know, cultural Marxist, you probably read a ton of these books. I have too. And, you know, but I think the law stuff just really, really needs to be sort of, you know, extracted. It's in there in the literature. And that's why, you know, my book, I think, is trying to contribute something new.
That's why everyone needs to read this book, because this, even if you haven't identified the origin of our politics, it is most certainly an origin of our politics. I mean, the law, you very, very clearly show over 250 pages or so, all these laws being enacted in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that are racist in the way that wokesters are racist. It's the same racism, in my view. There's no doubt about it. I just think there may be more going on. And I also do think that culture and law are kind of creating each other at this time. But I think you and I agree on that.
Yeah, we agree. It's just framing.
Now, I would say the other thing that you've, I think, damn near proved is that, again, even if it's not the origin of the way we think, nonetheless, these laws, these executive orders, et cetera, put some teeth into the new racial politics of the post-war era, right? Now you could actually be punished if you're a business owner or even sometimes a consumer in various ways. Certainly as a later on as a journalist, a public figure, you could be punished in various ways for being discriminatory against especially African Americans. So I mean, that seems to me to be a very important part of the story here that you've shown is that it's not just that the government sort of created these new races and then started fashioning new rules around those races, but it started punishing people and ordering people and engineering people and populations according to these new categories or old categories of race, right?
Yeah. And I think you could see this most directly in the university context. I mean, I was you know, floored researching this, that, you know, when the Nixon administration goes to Columbia University and they tell them, give us your data on the number of, you know, women and minorities you're hiring. And Columbia says, we're a university. I mean, we are an academic institution. We don't even have that data. Like us, Columbia University, like caring about race or gender of our hires, are you insane? And the president, you know, publicly writes an open letter saying the government is doing this to us and we're going to have to start, you know, we're going to have to change the entire nature of our institution. And they just do it. And this history is lost. I mean, this is not that long ago that, you know, the Berkeley too. I mean, this is the early 1970s.
Amazing. And you and I are both PhD graduates from Columbia. I was there in the 90s and 2000s. You were there a little bit later, but like, boy, that's a sea change. I mean,
yeah.
Because the Columbia,
I was a postdoc there, but yeah, same thing.
Okay, yeah, sorry, but anyway, yeah. I mean, race obsessed, like all of the elite schools are. Just everything is racial. Everything race must be imported into every question. It is the answer to every social question. Sorry, yeah. So things have changed a lot.
And then more recently, people will remember the Obama administration. You know, the last 10 years, they started doing all the stuff on Title IX, and you can find the stories in the New York Times. Oh, Harvard and Yale have to hire, you know, 5 women's studies majors now to, you know, manage the sex lives of their college students. So you could see that that's also like a more recent and very direct example of, you know, even after they're woke, they're still adding new stuff onto it based on what the law is.
Forgive me if you told this story in the book and I forgot about it. You might have even devoted a section to it. The 2011 Dear Colleague letter from Obama, which basically my thesis has always been, you probably make the same argument, that created the, this is a very Hananian argument, my view is that they created the whole sexual assault hysteria of 2012, 13, 14, 15. And I was right in the middle of that at Occidental College. It was kind of the epicenter there. So I saw it happening from the ground up. It was very clearly a response to the Obama administration saying, if you don't start enforcing Title IX around sexual assault, we're going to pull your federal funding. And then, of course, all the colleges in the world started doing just that and having these kangaroo courts and accusing poor little 18-year-old boys of rape and all the rest of it. So that's a very much, you know, legalistic, deterministic argument, right?
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I was just graduated from college at the time, but yeah, I know friends who were in college around that time, and man, it was like common, like you knew friends who had gotten caught up in one of these tribunals, and it wasn't there before. And I think it's just anecdotally, it seems to have leveled off now that Trump administration repealed a lot of those letters. They just withdrew them. I mean, I don't think anyone, like, it's very, you know, sneaky. You look at the history of the law. They start by, like, there's something called the Violence Against Women Act. And, you know, they renew it in like 2010 or 2011. And they just say, give us some statistics on, you know, just give us statistics on sexual assault on university campuses. And of course, the people writing the surveys and interpreting them are all these, you know, feminist crazy people. They come to the White House, they have a task force. Oh, 70% of them are being raped in college universities. The hysteria itself that justifies the Title IX.
They only said 33%. Let's not exaggerate.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm speaking hyperbolically. Are you sure it's just 33? I remember it was getting, you know,
it was 1 out of 5, and then it was 1 out of 4, and then finally they went to 1 out of 3 before the movement collapsed.
This was, you know, we remember this now. You don't have to go back to the 60s and 70s, you know,
right?
We all lived through this, and you can see how culture shapes up. You know, the transgender stuff more recently, I don't cover that a lot in the book because it's more recent, but you know, you can see a lot of these mandates come from up high, and you know, standoffs with local communities over this thing. This stuff goes to court. So, you know, you can see it as a recurring theme.
Another piece of this, connection. It's kind of a pipeline almost between, yeah, it has certainly become a pipeline between government, academia, and popular culture, right? And you see that now. I mean, another piece of this, I think it's very important. The people who tend to go to the elite, and we're talking about really the elite institutions here. It's not like the Oklahoma States. We're talking the elite, the people who tend to go to elite institutions are going there to be trained to be members of the political class. That's their whole purpose, really. The vast, these were my students, I know them. So they that's what they wanted to be. They wanted to be Supreme Court justices and congresspeople or just staff aides, you know, for senators or whatever it was. I have many ex-students who are doing just that right now. People who work for Tony Blinken, people who work for the mayor of Los Angeles, that's what they wanted to be. And so if the government, especially the Obama government, says something, but if the federal government says something, it carries so much weight to them. It must have some basis, you know, some validity. We must carry this out. If the government's telling us it's true, we must do it, right? That's, I think, a very important part of this cultural process.
That's a great point, because a lot of these, like, dear colleague letters, a lot of these, you know, sort of nudges, you know, nobody actually loses their federal funding. That's actually hard to do. You have to, like, have a hearing, and you like, if they actually wanted to take this to the court, a lot of times, you know, the universities would win. And they actually did on the sports stuff in Title IX in the 1990s. The universities used to say, why do we got to get rid of the wrestling team? This is stupid. This is not into the Title IX. And they fought and they lost the court cases. The judiciary is more conservative now. I think, you know, they would do a better job now, but especially on this kangaroo, even this kangaroo court stuff, it ended up, they ended up getting thrown out in court because the men themselves would challenge. But if the universities themselves wanted to stand up to this, they could have done so. So, you know, it is sort of like culture and law playing in together. It's like one of the reasons the civil rights establishment goes at the universities, well, first of all, it's the federal funding, right? Just they're so intertwined with the federal government. The second is it's the easiest place to get change because there's so many people that agree with, you know, what the civil rights regime does and what it wants to do.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, I think that's like a, you know, a huge part of like why universities have been particularly bad on all these things.
Again, I think there's a real institutional basis here. So you went to SIPA, which is the International Relations School at Columbia, which is one of the major feeders for whatever you want to call it, the foreign policy establishment. You know, Harvard, Kennedy School is another one. Hopkins, SAIS is another one in DC. Georgetown is another one, right? If the federal government defunded those schools, there would be no State Department, right? Because that's where the State Department comes from. It comes from students at those schools, like 95%, right? I mean, that's and the NSA and all, you know, and the NSC and all the rest of it. So this is a problem there. Let's do this now. So, okay, the thesis has been established that at least an important origin of wokeness is in the law. But you certainly don't want to say, do you, that wokeness has not changed since 1972?
No, it depends on what, you know, we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, like homosexuality, like, you know, changed. I mean, I remember even my childhood, I'm not that old, you know, how unacceptable it was to be gay. Now, you know, like 20% of girls or something are identifying as some kind of LGBT. Obviously, civil rights law didn't concern itself with that stuff. It does now. And the everything, you know, most of the other stuff, it's really a matter of degrees. Like the stuff about discriminating as African Americans, you can read about like the civil rights complaints from the 1970s and 80s, and they're not that it's like they stop blacks more often than whites. You know, they happen to use force against blacks more often. The police had this test, or they don't hire enough African Americans. The standardized tests, you know, being racist, we need, you know, quotas, or we need diversity or something. You know, that goes back to Bakke. I mean, that's the 1970s too. You know, it's like you do, like, it's not that nothing happened, and like especially since like George Floyd, nothing happened in the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, they've gotten a little bit more crazy. I mean, you know, it used to be like the EEOC would just sort of investigate, you know, somebody for, you know, there's cases of like the EEOC saying, oh, you have a tardiness policy that's discriminated against blacks, or like a policy where you know, you don't hire people with criminal records. You know, now it's like people, crazy people, like that would just sort of fly under the radar. Now crazy people who like say that, like, will be like, you know, Ibram Kendi will get like, you know, $1 million grant from some, you know, foundation and like be treated as the greatest genius of our generation. There is more of like taking the craziest stuff and like being unashamed of it and putting it front and centered and making it like sort of like the orbit around the around which the institution sort of, you know, rotates.
Yeah.
But it really is a matter of degree. And, you know, matter of degree is important because, you know, it's difference between hindering your mission a little bit and just sort of poisoning it. What people tell me is going on in medicine and academia is quite frightening, but it's just turning up the dial here.
What is called wokeness now was called identity politics in academia when I was in academia starting in the 90s. And in fact, I was a big part of this debate on the left in academia, the people who created all this shit. There was a huge split between the Marxist left and the new, we called it identity politics left. And it was a big fight in the 90s. It was really interesting. But things have changed, though, because the left did not used to be the liberal. And when I say the left, I mean liberals. Now I'm talking about sort of established Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was simply not nearly as authoritarian as it is now around issues of wokeness as it was in the 90s and even 2000s and maybe even the 2010s. And I think that a lot did change with Trump and that they suddenly had an actual, in their minds, devil, right? Because I grew up on the left where we were always inventing the devil, right? So it was the president of our college. He was the devil. He was doing terrible things and we must protest against him, right? The government, the CIA, we were always trying to find racists under every corner. Well, here's Trump. Okay, now he's the president. Oh my God, he is Hitler. We have to crack down now. We have to crack down because if we don't crack down, we're going to be living in the Third Reich. And therefore we have to steal elections and but I mean, we certainly, there was a tremendous step up in authoritarianism after the election of Donald Trump, wasn't there? Isn't that a change? Didn't wokeness become more militant, maybe even militarized, more violent?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things here that are sort of, you know, that we can sort of flesh out a little bit. So yeah, wokeness, is the Democratic Party more authoritarian? Like the Democratic Party, the upper levels of the Democratic Party are more woke. Like, you know, Biden is going out sending, you know, issuing executive orders that you all have to have equity plans, and all this other stuff. And then the free speech stuff on the university, you have, pressuring social media companies to censor speech. Yeah, I think they've talked themselves into, and I think, you know, I think some of the criticisms of Trump and like his, you know, his sort of disrespect for sort of some of the norms, I think some of that is sort of legitimate. And so they have this kernel of like truth that they're battling against. And some of the right-wing stuff is crazy and misinformation. That's true too. But they, you know, you're right, they've come to like the idea that, you know, the racism, whatever they call racism or sexism or homophobia, is sort of on the level of like, you know, like pedophilia or like these things that we used to all agree that like, okay, there's like a special case of like things that maybe we don't, you know, we, you know, it's like, you know, nobody complains that much about like Holocaust denial being shut down or like pedophilia. It's like not even, if like Twitter just censored that stuff, like conservatives wouldn't even care. But there's just been sort of like the left's attempt to like draw like a lot of just views that right-wing people have or like Americans have, a majority of Americans have, under that umbrella. And yeah, that's frightening. I mean, that's a terrible cultural change. And yeah, I'm glad to see some pushback on it. I do think there's like more of a, I mean, they have done like the right and they have done like pro-liberty types. They have done us a favor, because you can't really hide this. Like if I talked about this, like I saw this stuff, I ran into the civil rights law and the craziness of it in law school, 10-12 years ago. And like, you could bring it up to people and they wouldn't care because, you know, the debate at the time was like Obama wanted to give people health care, the Tea Party wanted small government. And that was the debate. They're like, you know, is anyone really paying attention to the race stuff? Does it matter? Now, you know, I go to a conservative audience, they're looking for answers. Like, what has happened to the world? What can we do? And, you know, they're primed to think about solutions here. So they might have helped in that regard.
Right. So, okay. All good so far. here's the big question I have. And I don't have an answer for it. I don't think you answer this in the book, really. Maybe you do. I don't think so. And something that still bedevils me about this whole thing, why on earth is it in the interest of the state to institutionalize identity politics and wokeness? Why was it in the interest of the United States, because we're talking about the federal government, to institutionalize all this stuff, all this racial preferences, et cetera, et cetera? Why would the state benefit from, why would the state want to do that? It seems like it might weaken the state to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, so my first book was Public Choice Theory and the Illusion of Grand Strategy. So
there you go.
I sort of have an answer from a different sort of field of study. But yeah, I mean, I argue against the idea that, you know, the state really is trying to strengthen itself. I see the state as sort of like these different parts and they're sort of competing with one another. And so, look, I think there was a genuine interest in I think like anti-racism became became sort of like the way like educated people separated themselves as like better than, you know, those uneducated people. So the less educated people, Southerners, you know, we care about the plight of African Americans. This is something, you know, in some ways noble that, you know, educated Americans told themselves and the people who went into government or journalism or academia. And actually there's, you know, a scholar I cited quite a bit of a book named John Screndeny, who writes about sort of like, how could you still show that you're, you know, that you're working on equality? You pass the Civil Rights Act, you say you can't discriminate, like, okay. But what if there aren't, you know, as many Black scientists as you like? What if there aren't any, you know, as many Black surgeons as you like? Well, you know, classifying people and getting the numbers and trying to set them as goals, it's a way you should show that you care, or forcing other people to do those things. And so like that sort of became, you know, I think a lot of the motivation here, same thing with women too. I mean, people, you know, want to show that they're concerned with women. A lot of women with it, like in the early days of, you know, the Title VI and the Title IX stuff, it was a lot of like women at elite institutions were really pestering the Office of Civil Rights. They were really pestering the federal government, like, oh, we're experiencing all this sexism. You know, they had this, you know, feminism. And so the pressure was coming from below. Does it strengthen or weaken? I mean, it strengthens certain parts of the state, right? The state can tell the government they can tell private institutions what to do. There's been some investigations and lawsuits filed against some of Elon Musk's companies. You know, you discriminated against asylum seekers and, you know, when you were looking for, you know, scientists for SpaceX. And so everyone's discriminating based on civil rights law all the time, because literally everything has a disparate impact. And so it is, you know, if you do want to see it from the perspective of government strengthening itself, there is that.
What's the story about Coinbase? That's a great story for this, right? What's the story again? That's a great example of the federal government basically using this stuff, this ideology and this legal regime against a company it didn't like for political reasons.
And it's not, you know, it's not centralized, but it's very interesting because this is Coinbase, you know, it's like a crypto marketplace. What, you know, people don't know what that means, whatever, it's just a business. And the CEO Brian Armstrong comes out, and this was sort of at the height of like the tech companies, like all the employees pressuring them to take woke positions, and Brian Armstrong comes out at Coinbase and says, you know, we're not going to be political. And this became a huge story. This was shocking at the time. It's actually we're like 2 or 3 years removed from that now, and it's not that shocking anymore, because there's been a little bit of a backlash to this. But it was if you don't remember, sir, trust me, it was shocking.
2020
crazy time. And so like they start like doing stuff like, you know, they like someone leaks like their pay database, and they don't have like, you know, controlling factors of, you know, different kind of things, but they show, oh, you know, the New York Times, the tech reporter, and a lot of tech reporters like don't know or care anything about tech. They're just like looking for a racism or sexism angle. And so the New York Times has a reporter like this, and he basically publishes, you know, it's basically like shining the light. Look, you might have, you know, government, you know, people who might sue. There's racism and sexism going on here. I looked at some data that somebody leaked in the company. And you see this, you see these sort of selective either prosecutions or like public pressure. And you know, the civil rights regime is not, or the all the civil rights lawyers out there, are there aren't enough of them to go after every potential claim of racism and discrimination in the country. And where do they focus on? Well, the media, is part of their job is to tell them, you know, where to look.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, that was essentially, I mean, it wasn't the federal government directly, but it was it was enabled by the federal government.
It was relying on the threat of the federal government power. Yeah. You might publish that story if you're, you know, the federal, if there was no civil rights law to do something about it.
So it's basically, it is a way for the government, for the state to discipline people and to punish companies and individuals that it doesn't like, because the state doesn't like cryptocurrency. It didn't like Coinbase. It would love to get rid of Coinbase and cryptocurrency generally, right? Because they see that as a legitimate threat, for obvious reasons. So yeah. Okay. Now, then we're left with what to do next. And the last, I guess it's the section of your book is devoted to this. What is to be done? The low-hanging fruit, as you call it in the book, is things like these executive orders signed in the 60s and 70s that can be reversed with a stroke of a pen with another executive order. So Biden or Trump or whoever the next president could do this instantly. Is that correct, by the way? Is it all could be done?
Yeah, there's, I mean, look, some liberal judge might find some kind of, you know, way to say you can't do that. But no, it's pretty solid. You can anything created by executive order can basically be taken away by executive order.
So no affirmative action for federal contractors.
Yeah.
Right. For instance. Okay. So that's one thing. That's very good. But then brother, you told me before we started recording that you're a libertarian, but then you say this, government should take a harder line. This is at the end of the book, against anti-white and anti-male discrimination and narrow definitions of discrimination as it is applied to women and minorities. So you want the government to go harder against different kinds of discrimination, the discrimination that you and I experience. And you want to narrow the definition of discrimination as it is applied to women and minorities. I understand the argument, but and the liberal in me likes it a lot, right? But that's heavy duty statism. I mean, I'm not sure I want the government protecting me. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, my ideal state of the world is freedom of association. I present these ideas and I say, look, you're not, I try to aim a practical book, but you know, I'm not a philosopher telling you my ideal system. I'm telling you what I think is plausible and what you can do through the courts and through a Republican. It has to be a Republican, of course, administration. My assumption is you're still going to have the Civil Rights Act. You're still going to have that 1964 Act. You're not going to pass two houses of Congress, get to pass a filibuster, have a president sign to repeal the civil rights or civic religion. I mean, that's just crazy. So if you have this law that says, you know, you can't discriminate against Black people and women, I mean, you have to read it, because if you just say whites and men, you know, you can sort of be a libertarian on discrimination against whites and men, but not Blacks and women or other minority groups. Mm-hmm. Well, you create every incentive to just do this diversity stuff. So yeah, I want ideally nobody would, you know, care about discrimination. You could do whatever you want. The second best option is treat everyone the same.
Okay. I you won me over on this. I mean, I get it within yeah. sort of reality. Yes. Yeah. I mean, within the regime that we're most likely going to be living under over the next 10 to 20 years, that's probably the best possible outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm pretty clear in the book that I just have libertarian dreams of just like institutions doing all kinds of crazy things and government not having anything to do with it. I want to get us closer to that point.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
Exactly. No, it's all good. Okay. Now we're going to talk about something where you're really not libertarian. Which is not so much in the book, but it's in a lot of other stuff you've written about and talked about, which it has to do with crime and race. And there was an attempted cancellation on you about a month ago, and you apparently were a very bad young man, and that is why we should not read your book. And your ideas about race that you held when you were 23 years old, or that's why no one should read your book or listen to what you have to say about politics. Let's see. Do I want to ask you biographical questions about what brought you to these dark corners of the internet? Or do I want to ask you about what you want to do about crime, which definitely disturbs me more than your alleged past? But let's do that second one first. Okay. So crime, and you've tweeted about this year, a tweet thread about, you wrote a whole long piece on Substack about it too. So high crime rates, at least higher than 5 years ago, not higher than the 90s, but I live in Oakland and East Oakland, and I am really ready for a little law and order, I gotta tell you. So I get you, I really do. And I've often lived in neighborhoods similar to that. So I do get that. You want to lock up a lot more people as the answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you are aware there's 2.3 million people, right, in the system, and that we have incarcerated more people in this country than any other country in the history of the earth. And our incarceration rate is something like double or triple that of Iran and Russia and China. So I don't quite get that one, but why don't you lay it out? Why do we need to put more people in prison in the incarceration capital of the world?
I mean, so if you look at the data, I mean, it's hard, you can talk about Iran or Russia. I don't know about, the data coming out of there. I mean, I know North Korea has these, multi-generational, camps, and people never
Fair
talk
point.
About Korea near the top. We are, and it's hard to compare us to the countries that do have good data, because we have, astronomically higher crime rates than, Norway or Sweden or whatever. But look, if you look at like the typical person who's arrested for murder in this country, they have multiple, arrests before that. I mean, very, very high numbers. So you have, you'll have, 5 or 10 arrests. So if that's like the typical, murder, you could basically get, locking up people long-term will basically get your murder rate down to zero. Now there's a, cost and benefit here. It's hard. I mean, we're in this situation because we have such a high crime rate. I think we probably do need to lock up more people. It's probably not the first thing. Like, if you tell me the first five things we need to do, I think we need more certainty of catching people who commit crimes. There's some like silly stuff like there's like cops want to sometimes use facial recognition technology. I don't know if some libertarians like that, some libertarians don't. I don't know how you feel about that. But to me, that's like, that's good. They say, oh, they sometimes misidentify people at progress. Okay, that's why you have a trial, and you can go prove it. People, eyewitness testimony misidentifies people all the time. It's probably worse. It's absurd. It's worse than the facial recognition technology. Mm-hmm. And there's Jennifer Doliak is academic who's written about DNA testing. You just basically, you arrest somebody, you take their DNA, and apparently like reduces the crime rate a lot. I mean, there's a lot of good evidence that, whoa, criminals think everything is, law and order, and like they're gonna, if the government has their DNA, they'll never be able to get away with anything again. I think that we do have to sort of, I would legalize, I'm a libertarian, I would legalize all drugs. I mean, I don't think we need to, go to war with Mexico or whatever over fentanyl. I think there's a lot of things we could be doing here. And I think we should treat this problem, and, liberals and some libertarians too, I think don't, they're sort of, you said, you're ready for law and order in Oakland. They don't treat this with the seriousness it deserves. We should feel ashamed that, I grew up in Chicago, it could have been other cities too, where like 25% of the city, you as an outsider can't walk the streets. You wouldn't feel safe doing it in the middle of the day. That's a disgrace. We really should not tolerate that, and look to see why that happened.
Oh yeah. No doubt about it. So I lived in New York, I've said this many times. Anyway, through the 90s, I got there in 91. I left in 2007. So I was there for the entire Giuliani administration. And I lived in a neighborhood that he went particularly hard on, the Morningside Heights. And Giuliani, I mean, his intention, and he almost lived up to this, was simply to lock up every criminal in New York City. Yeah. And he did a damn good job of that. And the crime rate in New York and the life in New York changed radically in my time there. When I got there in 91, there were naked people in the park next to where I live fighting over crack pipes, like in the middle of the day. No kidding. And it was terrifying to go on the subway. By the end of the 90s, the safest city in the country. Giuliani just locked up everybody. The incarceration rate skyrocketed and the crime rate plummeted. Okay.
Yeah.
And of course, if you lock up all the criminals, the crime rate's going to go down. This seems like an obvious point to me. Mm. So there's that in favor of what you're saying there. The other thing you said, though, sort of offhandedly, was, well, I'm for legalizing drugs. Now, do you know that the FBI estimated that something like 50% of all felonies are connected to the illegal drug trade, because people rob and steal because of the high cost of drugs. So they need more money. So that forces them to go out and commit theft. I think that if we legalize drugs, I'm not saying this would take care of all of it, but I think it would take care of a huge percentage of the crimes. Yeah. I think it'd be better. I'd rather do that than lock more people up. But then there's your boy Bukele in El Salvador, and I know you're a big fan. And I'm kind of a fan. I mean, he had MS-13, from what I can tell, like running much of that damn country and its economy, and it's arguably the most violent drug gang in history, which is saying a whole lot. And he just did what Giuliani did. He locked them all up, like all of them, in specially made new prisons out in the middle of nowhere in El Salvador, and then sent videos around the world showing everyone that he did this. It was quite something. And you like that. You like that. You want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I did a, you know, a little bit back of the envelope cost benefit. I said, you know, assume that, you know, this percent, I had an article where I said, assume like, you know, 20% of them are innocent or whatever, you know, the people Bukele's lock up. And then like, you actually go from, he took the country from the murder rate of Detroit, all of El Salvador had a murder rate of Detroit, to the US average. So I go, you're a young man, you have, you, your country can go from Detroit to the US, to the US average. But you get like a whatever percent chance it is of being locked up innocently, right? And, you know, I worked it out, and not 100% of people agreed with sort of like my conclusion that yes, you would be with the Bukele thing, because, you know, getting locked up is a, you know, really bad, and you're innocent gets, is a really bad option. But I think a lot of people did say, okay, I'll take the, you know, 95% chance of going to a normal country from Detroit, and, you know, a few percent chance of being locked up. And so, you know, I think that overall the policy has to be judged well. I think in the long run, you were, you know, because you worry obviously about innocent people. Like, there's probably going to be innocent people in Bukele. There's going to be innocent people in under any system. In the long run, you know, you get the crime rate down, and then you have less of a thing to worry about, because, you know, if there's nobody's going to jail for life for murder in Japan for the wrong person, because there is no murder in Japan, right? You get the crime rate low enough, the odds of, you know, getting locked up for something, you know, innocent, or for something you're innocent of, just goes down. So it's sort of, they're sort of like, this is an idea I've been sort of playing with, and maybe like researching a bit, maybe thinking I'm going to write about. There seems to be like this historical norm where countries go through this period where like they pacify first. They don't really, you know, they don't have human rights like this, like the US, like the way it fought crime through most of its history, or any, you know, any country that's first world today. They didn't have, you know, Miranda rights and like human rights lawyers and, you know, right to representation, free attorney, all this other stuff. They became sort of civilized countries first. And then they sort of, you know, it was sort of a luxury to have all these like civil liberties. It, but it seems like today we go to the third world. I think the Iraq war was part of this. It's like we went straight to like, you know, you don't even have control of your streets. Like the gang is running half the country. Okay, get every one of them a lawyer. Like it's just ridiculous. It doesn't work. And so like a best case scenario, Bukele, they don't have to do this forever, right? 5, 10, 15 years down the line, they could sort of, they have economic growth, they become able to afford better institutions. You know, who knows if that's the way it'll go. A lot of ways things go wrong in third world countries. But that would be the hope, the end goal of all of this.
All right. And you want to bring back the death penalty as part of this?
Yeah, I mean, the death penalty, I think, you know, the arguments against the death penalty are what? Somebody might, you know, it's the same thing
as you might get killed unjustly. Dude, Well, that's an interesting, I mean, it's sort of like the Rawls, what's he call it? The Rawls test, where you're like, John Rawls, where you have a choice.
Yeah.
How would you choose your perfect society if you were dropped into it, parachuted, not knowing what position you'd be in that society? Yeah. So like, would you trade? I mean, everyone listening should think about this. It's a fascinating question. You know, would you trade? Would you want to live in a world in which your society is generally quite safe? You're generally free from crime, safe from crime, but you have a chance, a small chance, but a chance of going to prison forever unjustly.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's it. And I guess you're saying that most people, I guess you did this study, most people do choose that. That's what they do want. And that's kind of what they get.
I just sort of, I informally asked people on Twitter and stuff. Okay. They seem to agree with me. Maybe I'm on the Rawls thing. I always want, like, I'm for high risk, high reward. So I'm like the kind of person who will say, okay, more inequality, you know, and
right.
You know, like a typical libertarian. But yeah, the other thing about stopping crime, it's not like the odds of getting murdered or getting robbed will go down if a low crime society. It's a precondition for economic growth. I mean, it absolutely murders you're not only being safer, you're also going from a third world country to first world. Look, people take major risks. People, you know, they go, you know, they die in the desert try to cross the border from Mexico or try to get to Florida from Cuba. I think, you know, the kind of person who, you know, I think if you find yourself in a third world country or violent or, you know, extremely poor, I think those calculations look different. And that's what the people, you know, that's why I think Bukele has a 90% approval rate, because these people understand this.
That's exactly right. Okay. Last thing we're going to talk about is probably the thing you least want to talk about, but which has to do with black people. And I know you have lots of feelings about black people.
I don't have any problem. Oh, come on. I'm fine talking about black people.
Do you have black friends?
I have Twitter mutuals. I have Twitter mutuals.
So oh, okay. Yeah, right. Nice that's it, close enough, right? Yeah. All right. Yeah. So, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, whatever. And by the way, just so you know, I don't give a shit. I mean, I'm like, this is morality. I don't care at all. I'm just curious about it. I do want to talk to you about race realism. So you dabbled in race realism in your 20s. You wrote for some right wing naughty magazines, I guess, and said some things about blacks and women and yada yada. I don't know. So I've been looking for a long time, Richard, for like an intelligent proponent of race realism, and I got to tell you, I've had a hard time finding it.
Well, the intelligent ones keep their mouths shut.
Is that it?
Shut, I think. Yeah.
Is that it? Yeah.
Because there are people. I could point you to people who have Substacks who are are academics that are really smart people. And
please,
you talk to them. Sure.
No, seriously, I'd love to do that. Yeah, yeah. So now you renounced your past politics on your Substack a few weeks ago and said that you sucked. That's your word. And that you don't have these, it's not just race, but I want to focus on race. You don't have these ideas about race anymore. So I guess I want to hear how you've changed your mind, because I'm really curious. I'm just interested in both race realism, which is just a form of racism, which is, again, I don't give a shit. That could be fine. I just want to hear the argument. I'm just as interested in that as I am in anti-racism, which has filled my mind since I was 4 years old. I'm much more interested in the other side. So why don't you talk about what was going on 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and why those ideas were attractive to you, and what is it about them?
Yeah.
And then why are you now renouncing them?
So the ideas that, you know, I held 10, 15 years ago was the idea that we shouldn't treat people as individuals. Now, the idea that there are statistical differences between groups, there's not tons in the way of, you know, disproof of that. I mean, men and women are obviously different. I'm a Middle Easterner, and Palestinians and the Jews have a problem. And I think if someone told me that the Jews were smarter than the Arabs, I would not be surprised or shocked or offended by that. I think what we shouldn't do, I'll tell you how I changed my mind on this, is, say that justifies, say, white ethnic politics, or that justifies, you know, treating people differently on account of race. So like something I changed my mind about a lot was, like, I was a really big immigration restrictionist. I thought, oh, well, these people, you know, they might not be that smart. They'll maybe commit more crimes. The country will be worse off. Part of it was moving to California, and I saw like how hardworking and productive a lot of the people who were either illegal or, first generation immigrants were. Really thinking about sort of the free market arguments of people like Brian Kaplan, who's a good friend now, and Alex Nawasta. Mm-hmm. They say, even take the IQ stuff, you know, at face value and say that, you know, there are IQ differences. We still benefit from the division of labor. That argument does not change. It doesn't depend on. And a lot of the race realists are, in fact, like, a lot of the arguments, the race realists who dislike immigration, a lot of them do use kind of like socialist arguments. They'll say, oh, well, the poor people, they take in, they use more, government services than they pay in taxes. And that's just like, the measure is what? Like a state balance sheet of like how valuable a person is. It's like, no, they have jobs. Like the private sector is like where our productivity comes from. So even if they use something, you know, more than they pay in taxes, they can still be very productive people. And I think just collectively sort of shutting people out because of a group average, I think is right. If you're concerned about crime or you're concerned about whatever, you can deal with that. So I don't think they're, you know, people should be canceled or like shy away from like looking at, you know, statistical differences between groups. That being said, I think liberty is great. It's better for all people, and we should not care about disparate impact, and also not give into the temptation of any kind of, you know, white identity politics or identity politics for any group.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I like all that. What was this thing about the division of labor? What's Brian Kaplan's argument about the division of labor and immigrants?
It's just basically a Ricardoian argument applied to, you know, groups rather than countries, right? It's just like, okay, even if I'm better than my gardener at gardening and everything else in the world, I'm not saying I am, but let's say I was.
Yeah.
you know, it's just you know, the comparative advantage. I mean, it's really just a sort of a simple argument that you're still better off if, you know, people focus on what they're good at and trade with each other.
Oh, like we wouldn't have gardeners if we didn't allow Mexican immigration. Is that what you mean?
I mean, we might have gardeners. They might be
not
more
many.
Less affordable. Yeah, exactly.
we certainly wouldn't have any restaurants. I mean, all the white people in LA would starve to death if we ceased immigration. I'm not kidding. I mean, have you ever looked in the restaurant kitchen? Every damn one of them has Salvadorans and Mexicans working.
The race. I mean, it's interesting. I think race realists, they complain about California. It's interesting. You know, Steve Saylor lives out here. We've gone together, and it's funny because like people like Steve Saylor will say stuff like, you know, these liberals are, you know, they love diversity, but they live in white neighborhoods. But Steve Saylor lives in LA County, just like I do. So why isn't he moving to Appalachia, right? So I think anyone who lives out here, they sort of, you know, they get it. They see sort of like, you know, people generally get along, you know, despite the liberals and despite the stupid identity politics they're pushing. People generally are just doing their jobs and getting along. And it's, you know, I'm optimistic about the American system and, you know, how it's working out.
Yeah, I agree. So wait, I didn't hear you renouncing race realism. I heard you renouncing the politics that flow from race realism. But I mean, it sounds like you do believe in IQ as a meaningful marker of distinction.
I think that IQ is real. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's
of course it's real. But I mean, like, what does it mean to you? Like, what isn't the intelligence quotient? What does that mean to you?
I think it's a good, I mean, I think I don't want it to have like a dominant, I think we have actually put too much emphasis on it. I think it's like, you know, our basic, you know, people sometimes they'll hate affirmative action, they'll hate wokeness, they'll go to merit, but then merit will just be defined as your SAT score, right? And I dislike it. Maybe it's better than affirmative action and wokeness. It's at least something objective. But, you know, I would rather have markets and, you know, there's different kinds of intelligence that could blossom and what people want to pay you for and what, you know, you can contribute to the world. Great. You know, I don't denounce the idea that like IQ is measuring something real that correlates with productivity in most jobs. I think that's, you know, I think the literature is pretty clear on that. So yeah, sure. I think a mistake was fetishizing. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And I think a lot of the people who react to wokeness and say liberals are just making stuff up, they go too far in that direction. So, you know, that clarifies.
Yeah, no, I think it measures certain kinds of intelligence, right? I mean, like the ability to do most jobs, not all jobs, by the way, but I'd say most jobs, right? I think a high IQ correlates with good performance, no doubt about it.
It's like a question is like, yeah, who cares? Like, just let people do the jobs.
And exactly.
Then pay them for it, do it. But it's because
exactly.
People are into this mentality of like college admissions has to be race admissions or it has to be IQ.
Exactly. Like, this is what
the market is the option. Exactly.
It's what I've always wanted to say to these right-wing race realists. It's like, okay, let's say you're right. Okay, let's say black people are X percent dumber than whites, scientifically determined. What do you want to do about that in terms of policy, right? Like, that's...
Well, to be fair to them, some of them will say that this is just a response to the left that wants to equalize outcomes between all groups. So they will say that's the...
Cool. If they want to eliminate law... based on that's great. I always want to eliminate law, but I mean, it seems like they want a different kind of law that's going to rearrange that old division of labor you like so much.
Well,
right?
I think that's like you have to distinguish between white nationalists and people who are just race realists can be, you know, there are liberals and centrists who are race realists, but yeah, I think when you're talking about a white nationalist, I think you're right.
Right. Okay. So how successful has the cancellation been?
It's been not very successful. Good. I mean, the book has, you know, pre-sales have been doing very well. I posted some stuff. You know, the guy, you know, he really tried to went out of his way. He, you know, harassed the publisher for weeks afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
He tried to get, you know, like different people to denounce me that I'd had associations with.
Was this Katz? Jonathan
no,
Katz?
No. Well, Katz has written about me too, but the guy.
Yeah, I know Katz a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who wrote the Huffington Post piece is a name, I think Chris Mithias or something like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He tried to, you know, and I had a tweet thread where I said, okay, he said, will you, University of Texas denounce me? Like the, you know, I had a fellowship with them that just ended on its own, not related to this. And like, nope, that didn't happen. Will HarperCollins cancel me? Nope. I have a lecture at Stanford I'm going to give in October. Like, did that happen? No, I'm still here. You never know, like any, you know, a person might dislike me, you know, more because of this, and I might lose an opportunity or something. But as far as like everything the guy was aiming for, Yeah, nothing's changed.
Good. It's amazing how obvious it was an attempt to sink your book.
That's like, his mistake. I mean, that is his mistake. If he was a little more subtle, I think next time, you know, I want to give him advice for being a better canceller, but you know, yeah, he could do a better job next time.
It was really funny. I just remember one, I forget which day it was, but one day on Twitter, that's what everybody was talking about, how Richard Hanani is racist.
You know, I'm usually on Twitter all day. I took like 3 days off of Twitter. It was just like, you know, I'm not going to pay attention to all this stuff. So it was, I just come back, I wrote my response, and then, you know, people who hated me before still hated me, and people who liked me still liked me, and, you know, not much change otherwise.
As with everything, it just, everyone forgets about it and we move on. Yeah. So it's interesting. Well, my friend, yeah, this has been great. You're coming to Stanford in October?
October 5th. Yeah.
I might have to come check you out. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this. This has been great. And yes, everyone go seriously read Origins of Woke. As I said, it is the best history I have read on this topic. And I've read some good histories on it too. It is an absolutely essential part of the story of the time we are living in. And Richard, you are great. And the thing I want to tell you, and I said this before we started recording, but I want to say it in public, like, you are a singular thinker, man. And I appreciate that. People hate you from every part of the spectrum. People love you from every part of the spectrum. It's, you know, I love some things you say. I hate some things you say. I mean, that means you're a great public intellectual right there. There you go.
Well, thank you, Thaddeus. I mean, that's really kind of you to say, and yeah, it was great being here.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a patron of the show and have access to bonus episodes, AMAs, and the unreported news analysis show, go to patreon.com/unregistered. Thanks for listening.